Small change in the language. Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So let's dive in. We need to talk about this whole dogma of toxic gain of function.
Right.
In rare disease genetics, it's sort of the default, right? The go-to explanation.
What we're all taught, yeah. You find a mutation, the protein misfolds, it stresses the cell, and boom, the cell dies. A clean, logical story.
But what if that story is just, well, too simple? There's a new paper out that suggests this whole narrative might be leading us to, misdiagnose thousands of patients.
It's a classic case where the textbook theory was so strong we almost missed what the biology was actually telling us. We're looking at a scenario where it's not about toxicity at all, it's more about a threshold.
Specifically, we're talking about the INS gene,
yep.
Insulin production. For years, we thought a certain mutation here was like a dominant bully. You know, one bad copy and it just crashes the whole system. But this new work shows that the body is surprisingly resilient. It can handle a broken gene as long as you've got a backup. It basically rewrites the whole story of this type of diabetes from a killer disease to more of a logistics failure.
A traffic jam. A logistics failure that went unnoticed in parents for decades just because we weren't asking the right question. We weren't looking at zygosity.
And that's the hook for today's deep dive. We're looking at how a single amino acid change can trick us into thinking a cell is dying when really it might just be on strike.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Today we're diving into a paper titled "A New Form of Diabetes Caused by INS Mutations Defined by Zygosity, Stem Cell, and Population Data," which was published in MBO Molecular Medicine on January 3, 2026.
And this was a massive effort from Yutong, Miriam Snop, and their team at the ULB Center for Diabetes Research in Brussels. They also had collaborators from Luxembourg, Exeter, and Helsinki, a big team.
What I really appreciate here is the way they tackled it. It's this methodological triad. They didn't just stop at what they saw in the clinic.
No, not at all.
They integrated huge population scale data, CRISPR-corrected stem cell models, and even AlphaFold predictions to really build their case.
It's the modern genomic toolkit in action. I mean, they essentially had to build a human pancreas in a dish to solve a puzzle that had confused clinicians for years.
Okay, so let's set the stage. We're talking about monogenic diabetes.
Right, so this isn't type 1, which is autoimmune, or type 2, which is more about metabolic resistance. This is caused by a defect in a single gene.
And in this case, the gene is INS.
The gene that codes for pre-pro insulin, it's the blueprint. If you break the blueprint, you break the body's ability to regulate its blood sugar.
The specific mutation we're focused on is called R6C, arginine to cysteine. And historically, this has been stamped as autosomal dominant.
That's right. And the logic, you know, it made sense based on the biochemistry. The mutation swaps an arginine for a cysteine at the sixth position of the protein.
And cysteine is sticky.
Cysteine is very sticky. It forms disulfide bonds. So the assumption was that this extra cysteine just wreaks havoc with how proinsulin folds inside the endoplasmic reticulum, the ER.
So the theory was this misfolded protein builds up, it triggers the unfolded protein response, the UPR, and that just stresses the beta cell until it commits suicide. Apoptosis.
That's the classic toxic gain of function model. One bad allele poisons the whole well.
But the authors of this study saw something that just didn't fit. They had these probands, these kids, with really severe early onset diabetes, diagnosed at like age 9 or 11. Mm. But their parents, who carry the exact same variant, were fine. Clinically, you couldn't tell them apart from the general population.
And there's the paradox. If R6C was really a dominant toxic agent, those parents should have had significant beta cell loss. But they didn't. They were walking around with normal fasting glucose.
Which really implies that zygosity is the key here. The kids were homozygous, two bad copies. The parents were heterozygous, one bad, one good.
But to prove that, you have to do more than just point that out. You have to prove that the single mutant allele isn't stressing the cell. You have to actively disprove the old toxic theory.
You need to see the machinery in action.
You really do.
So let's get into how they did that, their methodology. They started with big data, right? Mm-hmm. To check how common this thing even is.
Yep. They scoured the UK Biobank, Geisinger, NOMED, these massive databases. Mm-hmm. And they found that R6C is present in about 1 in 25,000 people. So it's rare, but not, you know, once in a lifetime rare.
Okay.
And here's the crucial part. The heterozygous carriers in the UK Biobank did not have a higher rate of diabetes than non-carriers.
Wow. Okay, so that's a massive statistical blow to the dominance theory right there.
It's a huge one. Statistically, having one copy doesn't seem to make you sick, but, you know, statistics aren't a mechanism. To understand why, they went for the gold standard. isogenic iPSCs.
Induced pluripotent stem cells.
Exactly. They took blood cells from the patients, reprogrammed them back into stem cells, and then pushed them to become pancreatic beta cells. But here is the really elegant step. They used CRISPR-Cas9 to correct the mutation in those same cells.
And that's so critical because it gets rid of all the genetic background noise.
Yeah.
You end up with two cell lines that are perfect genetic twins, except for that one single letter change.
It's the perfect controlled experiment. You have the patient's homozygous cells, and you have the CRISPR-corrected version as your isogenic control. They also made heterozygous lines to mimic the parents.
And they didn't just watch from the dish. They actually put these human beta cells into mice to see if they worked in a living system.
Plus, they used AlphaFold 3 to model the protein structure. I mean, they threw the kitchen sink at this problem.
So let's get to the findings, because this is where that traffic jam idea really comes into play.
Right.
When they looked at the homozygous cells, the ones with two bad copies, what did they see?
They found that insulin secretion was just slashed. It was down by about 50%. The cells were barely putting out any functional protein.
Okay, but why?
Well, the reason was completely unexpected. It wasn't about misfolding inside the ER. It was about getting into the ER in the first place.
The signal peptide.
The signal peptide, yes. So preproinsulin had a little tag on the front, a sequence of amino acids that's like a VIP pass, a molecule called the signal recognition particle. The SRP sees this pass and basically drags the whole protein-making machine to the ER membrane.
Like the bouncer at a club.
It's the bouncer. And it docks with a channel, a little door called the Sec61 translocon, and shoves the protein through.
Into the factory.
Into the factory. But what AlphaFold 3 predicted was that the R6C mutation, that single swap it, drastically lowers the hydrophobicity of the signal peptide. It messes up the VIP pass.
It changes the physical properties of the key so it doesn't fit in the lock.
Pretty much. The model suggested the pass either fails to be recognized by the bouncer, the SRP, or it tries to go through the door, the Sec61 channel, all wrong, maybe even upside down.
So the protein just never enters the factory.
Exactly. It piles up in the cytosol, which is the fluid outside the factory. It's a translocation failure, a traffic jam at the front door.
And wait, this explains why the old toxic gain-of-function theory was wrong. If the protein never even gets into the ER.
It can't cause ER stress.
Right.
Spot on. They looked for all the classic markers of ER stress and apoptosis, you know, cell death, and they found nothing. The homozygous cells weren't dying. They were just sort of dormant.
That's fascinating. So they're not dead. They're just on strike. They can't do their job because the raw materials can't get through the door.
Or maybe idling is a better word. The study showed that protein translation gets repressed. It's a mechanism called the integrated stress response to stop that pileup in the cytosol from getting out of hand. The cell basically says, whoa, stop the assembly line, but the cell itself is perfectly viable.
Okay, so that brings us back to the parents,
yes.
Heterozygotes.
Yeah.
Why are they walking around perfectly healthy?
Because they have one good copy, one functional INS allele. And that one good gene produces enough correct signal peptides to keep the bouncer happy and the doors open, the traffic flows.
So one lane on the highway is enough.
It is. The study showed that the heterozygous cells had insulin secretion levels that were pretty much comparable to the healthy controls. The bad protein that gets made just gets cleaned up by the proteasome in the cytosol, and the good protein from the other allele keeps the lights on.
This completely flips the script for genetic counseling then. We're moving R6C from dominant to recessive loss of function.
It's a huge relief for these families. I mean, parents no longer have to feel like they've passed down some kind of poison that's also hurting them. And clinically, it tells us that heterozygous carriers are mostly fine, but their, let's call it their reserve capacity, is a bit thinner.
The study mentioned environmental stress.
Yeah.
Like obesity or pregnancy.
Exactly. This fits perfectly with the two-hit hypothesis. The genetics kind of load the gun. You have a slightly smaller engine, but it's the environment that pulls the trigger. The parents in the study were generally healthy, but some did develop mild diabetes later in life, especially if they became obese or, for the mothers, during pregnancy.
Gestational diabetes. That makes total sense. Pregnancy puts a massive demand on insulin production. If you're already running at, say, 50% capacity because one of your genes is down,
Yeah. You're
much more likely to hit that wall.
You are, but it's not the inevitable severe early onset disease we once thought. It's a susceptibility, not a sentence.
So what about the kids, the homozygous patients? The study confirmed they had very low C-peptide, so almost no insulin production. Did the researchers try any treatments on their models?
They did. They treated the mice, the ones carrying the human homozygous beta cells, with GLP-1 receptor agonists. drugs like Exendin 4.
So, similar to the Ozempic or Trulicity class of drugs we hear so much about, did it work? Did it kickstart the factory?
Well, it improved their blood glucose a little, but mostly by suppressing glucagon. It did not restore insulin secretion.
Because the door is still jammed.
The door is still jammed. You can press the accelerator all you want, but if the fuel line is cut, the engine won't start. GLP-1 agonists stimulate the secretion machinery, but if the protein can't get into the ER to become insulin in the first place, all the stimulation in the world isn't going to help.
That's a really critical insight for treatment. It tells doctors that pushing these beta cells harder with certain drugs just isn't going to work. The problem is structural.
It confirms that for these homozygous patients, insulin replacement therapy is, for now, the only way to go. But on the bright side, because the cells are alive and not dead, it theoretically opens the door for something like gene correction down the road. If you could CRISPR that typo back to normal, those cells should wake right up.
Looking at the bigger picture, this makes me a little worried about our genetic databases. I mean, we all rely so heavily on things like ClinVar to tell us if a mutation is pathogenic or not.
It should make us worry. This study is a warning shot. How many other variants are sitting in those databases classified as pathogenic or dominant simply because we haven't looked closely enough at the parents?
We could be overdiagnosing risk in thousands of carriers while completely missing the real mechanism in the patients who are actually sick.
It's a call to action. We need to revisit all these variants of uncertain significance, the VUS pile, with real functional assays. We can't just rely on the old dogma of dominance anymore. We need to look at the protein mechanics. We need to verify zygosity.
It really highlights that tension between what you see in the clinic, the phenotype, and the molecular reality. The disease looked dominant because you saw it in every generation with sick kids.
But the genotype required a recessive explanation. And honestly, without the big population data from the UK Biobank, we might never have spotted all those healthy carriers who were the first clue that the story was wrong. It just shows how essential big data is for understanding rare disease.
So if we boil this entire deep dive down, what's the one message you want our listeners to take away?
The central insight is that the INS R6C mutation is not a dominant toxic killer. It is a recessive traffic jam caused by a faulty address label, the signal peptide on the insulin protein. One good copy of the gene is enough to keep the factory running, but two bad copies shut down production, though they leave the cell itself intact.
It's a fundamental shift from cell death to cell dysfunction. And that shift really, really matters.
It matters immensely. And it leaves us with this one last provocative thought. If we start reanalyzing other so-called dominant monogenic diseases with this level of scrutiny, you know, combining stem cells and population data, how many other incurable degenerative diseases will turn out to be treatable trafficking defects? I mean, are we misinterpreting the silence of the cell for its death?
That is a fascinating and maybe slightly unsettling possibility. A humbling reminder that biology is rarely as simple as our textbooks make it seem.
Absolutely.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base. Small change in the language, a whisper in the code. A single light still shines and keeps the hours slow. But when the mirror doubles what was hidden at the gate, the factory stalls and the day begins to wait. Hands at the doorway, signals out of line. A crowded hallway where the bright things lose their time. We trace the pattern, follow where the shadows sigh. Two copies brought the silence, two copies broke the chain. We read the map and learned to call the name. Now we hold the pieces, light the work, relight the flame. Whoa, whoa.
shelves of gifts held tight. One voice can steady through a long and quiet night, but burden double, promise thins into the fight. We watched in patient gardens where small seeds were grown, found how doors were closing, how the rhythm was overthrown. Population maps and lab-born echoes showed what was sold. Two copies brought the silence, two copies broke the chain. We read the map and called.